Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the inside story. This episode, I met with Jason Gao, Chief Operating Officer of Land Solutions. Jason takes us on a journey from the family farm to life on the rigs to eventually leading one of the most complex consultation undertakings in Canada. Let's dive into the conversation with Jason. All right, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. We go back quite a number of years, you and I, to the old college days.
Over half our life, actually, if you take into consideration that we're in our late 40s now.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. Time flies.
It does, yeah. I don't know if we're any smarter now, but...
Just wiser.
Yeah, well, older looking, too.
Yeah. So you and I met at the midway point of our lives in Olds College. Tell us a little bit more about your background leading up to college.
Well, I grew up on a farm just west of Tabor, near a small village actually called Barnwell. Irrigation farm. We had some cows until I was probably about 11 or 12 before Dad got tired of those and sold them all off. I knew probably by the time I was about 14 or 15 that I didn't want to farm. I mean, farming was a lot different back then and much smaller scale than it is now. And so wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but by the time I finished high school, I needed to make that decision and thought that I might want to become an accountant or a lawyer because I heard they made a lot of money. So I went to Mount Royal College, it's now Mount Royal University, for 2 years in the Bachelor of Commerce Transfer Program. And after 2 years, decided that that's not what I wanted to do. And my uncle was a tool push on the rigs at the time. I was looking for a job and he said, why don't you come do this? And so ended up working on a little single drilling rig for a company called Akita Drilling. The first winter wasn't too bad. I mean, it was making pretty good money and it was a pretty mild winter. Second winter, I remember I was working up north of Edmonton around the Wabasca area. And it was minus 52 with the wind chill. And working outside, you know, it was like 3 a.m. I literally remember the moment that I decided I'm not going to do this anymore. And I had a couple friends going to Olds College and called one of them up on my rotary phone probably at the time and asked them. This was in about 1993, actually early 1994, and asked them to send me a course calendar, which arrived in the mail a couple weeks later, and had no idea what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to go to Olds College because I was doing a bit of rodeo at the time and they had a good rodeo program and it sounded like a fun college. So landed on the land agent program. After reading the course calendar, it looked like a good program. I could use my farming background and my recently learned oil field background to help me in my career. So applied, got in, and started there in September of 1994, which would have been probably the same week that I met you.
Did you know what a land agent was? Were you prior to that? Like, did you have any exposure to that growing up on the farm?
No, I mean, you know, growing up at Tabor, there was a lot of oil and gas activity, but we actually didn't have any on our land. Subsequent to me becoming a land agent, my dad was approached by some land agents to drill wells on his land. But prior to that, had no experience with a land agent. What I knew about a land agent was, I think, the paragraph or two that described what a land agent did in the course calendar. And quite frankly, you know, I did no further investigating on it prior to getting into the program. I probably learned more in that first couple classes with Oris Kroniski, who was our instructor at the time, main instructor, learned more from him about what a land agent does in that first hour of instruction at Olds than I knew previously.
You know, we had some oil and gas activity in our land growing up, but actually, you know, near Devon, where I spent part of my life, there was lots. But I just hadn't paid attention to it. So I kind of had a similar path where it's like, I just ended up there. And then, you know, once I was there, thought, oh, well, this is kind of neat. So once you went through the Olds College program and got out of Olds, where did you end up from there?
Yeah, I graduated from the program in April 96. There were not a lot of jobs at the time. I think there were about 16 or 17 people in our graduating class. And at that time, the land agents and land admins were combined. I think there were about 13 or 14 in the land agent program and 5 or 6 in the admin program. And I would say only, you know, 2 or 3 had jobs, you know, prior to graduating. Right before I graduated, I think it's probably a week before, I had heard that, you know, Scott Land was looking for someone out in Regina. And I don't remember if I heard that through a friend, or I frankly can't remember how I found out about that. But anyways, I called him up, you know, sent my resume in, or probably dropped it off. That was before I had an email account. So he didn't email it. I probably snail mailed it or dropped it off at their front reception, and then got a call a few days later. I remember, actually, I was back working on the rigs because I didn't have a job as a land agent. So my uncle asked if I wanted to come back working on the rigs that summer. I was back out in Brooks working on the rigs. It was like the first week of May. And my uncle came out from his shack, his well site shack, and said, I had a call. And I took the call. And it was, I can't remember if it was Andy Fulford or Arnie Brownlee's from Scott Land who was on the phone, asked me if I wanted to come for an interview and the next day. And so, you know, being it was my uncle, I said, hey, my apologies, but I got to take the day off tomorrow and run into Calgary for this interview. Went for the interview, and you know, I still remembered. I chatted with Andy and Arnie about this, you know, since that time. But they say they hired me because I had, of all the applicants, had the most reliable truck, reliable enough to make it through a Saskatchewan winter, because my grandfather had passed away a few months prior, and I bought his old truck off my grandmother, and it was, you know, a newer truck for a recently graduated college student. So had that truck, and it was literally one of the questions they asked me, what kind of truck I had. I think it was because I was the only one that applied for a job in Regina when everybody from Saskatchewan was moving to Alberta at that time. I was like one of the few, if not the only one, moving to Saskatchewan to take a job. Obviously, a lot's changed since then, but back then, there was a mass migration of people from Saskatchewan, including my wife, coming to Alberta.
Yeah. So you got the job with Scott Land, and then they sent you out to Saskatchewan. Is that?
Well, the intent was to work in Saskatchewan. I knew that going into it. So, yeah, I literally got the call 2 days later saying I had the job, pack up and be out there in 2 days. So I quit my job on the rigs, went back to Tabor, loaded up my pickup with whatever I could load it up with, and which was basically just my clothes and I think my stereo. And ended up staying in a hotel for, I think, the first 2 months I was out there before I ended up getting a house with a couple of other guys from Scotland.
Yeah. Well, I guess one thing is, you, for starters, you were already accustomed to living out of a bag.
I was, for
sure. You worked on the rigs. And you were upgrading occupation to a large degree.
Yeah, upgrading occupation. And, well, I mean, you know, I actually enjoyed working on the rigs other than when it was really cold. I don't like real cold. But, I mean, the work was good. The camaraderie was awesome. You know, the guys that I worked with, you know, still stay in touch with a couple of them to this day. You know, it was good, like, honest, hardworking, you know, a job. But I knew it wasn't something that I'd be able to do for my entire life. So, yeah, I mean, upgrade in that respect. But I did enjoy it. Yeah. I think the biggest upgrade was my accommodation, living in hotels and hot rooming with the, you know, the night crew and the day crew, hot rooming hotel rooms. You'd have 8 guys sharing a hotel room, the four guys on one crew, the day crew sleeping in the beds during the day, and then the night crew coming in. Did that for a bit. Although, I mean, for the most part, each crew had their own room.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, good on you. For a lot of guys that start out that way don't, you know, they get used to the paycheck and then don't ever move on from that. So it can be a bit, the money can be a bit of a trap.
Yeah, no, it can. It was good money for someone that, you know, had a high school diploma and a half finished university degree.
Okay, so you start working. Now, what was it, what you expected?
I feel like they prepared us pretty well at Olds College for what to expect. We had to do a 2-week practicum, you know, a couple months before graduation. So I did that, you know, so you got a good idea of what you were getting into. I was, you know, there wasn't much training involved on the job. I went out with a more senior land agent, Mark Brady, who I still keep in touch with, you know, this day. He took me out for a couple of visits, and then I was out on my own, primarily doing freehold mineral leasing, with a bit of surface land leasing as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I think back to my beginnings in land, I don't know that it ever really occurred to me how important the work was. You know, I don't know that I actually saw the big picture that well. Like, where were you at? Would you describe something similar when you got started? Like, or did you grasp sort of the magnitude of the bigger picture of what you were doing?
I think I had a bit of a bigger picture view, and only because I had worked on the rigs for, you know, for a couple of years, a year and a half prior to, you know, to going back to school, to going to Olds. So I knew at least, you know, why I was signing those mineral leases, why I was signing that surface lease, because a drilling rig would then come in, which, you know, which I worked on. And then after that, a pipeline crew would come in and tie that well in. So, I mean, that was probably the extent of it. You know, I knew up to that point, you know, but the whole, you know, how it gets processed, the, you know, the compression, the, you know, the pumping, how it gets into your vehicle, you know, that piece was probably missing, you know, as far as the big picture, but, you know, maybe a little bit more than I guess a little more big picture than you knew, but not a lot more.
Your background, when you look back, your background, having spent that time on the rigs and having come from an agricultural upbringing, did that help you in the role? Do you think that kind of enabled you more so than somebody that didn't have that kind of a background?
Well, I definitely used it to my advantage. I mean, I'd, you know, go into a, you know, a farmer's house, landowner's house, and, you know, right away, you know, the conversation would inevitably turn to, you know, where are you from, you know, kind of what's your background. And, you know, I think it gave me street cred with that landowner, you know, that I had, you know, a farm background. So you start discussing that right away. And sometimes it would turn to my, you know, the previous oil and gas background of working on the rigs, not as much, but certainly the conversation would usually turn to, you know, my background growing up on a farm.
Yeah, the rapport is such a important piece, and I think it's often underestimated how important that piece of the work is, really the initial rapport building aspect. And again, I don't, you know, looking back on my start, I don't think I fully grasped that either, although I think similar to you, had some things that helped me build that rapport because of the ag background, et cetera. So kind of by chance, it worked out. But I think, you know, I think in today's environment, in certain cases anyways, that's even more important, the rapport and how you go about building that. Like when you first started out, did you have kind of, I guess, an intentional philosophy when you went out to meet with people? Like, were you winging it? Did you kind of have a foundation for how you would go about that initial engagement?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, you know, back then, you know, and I'm diving deep back into my brain here, but you know, it really was all about just getting the agreement signed, especially on the freehold mineral leasing side. Because if you weren't leasing those minerals, then there was probably another land agent representing another company that was waiting in the driveway to lease those minerals, especially in, you know, in some of the hotter plays. So the pressure was on to, you know, to get those leases signed, like, and basically get it signed in that first visit. So you only had one shot to make a good impression, and to convince that Freehold Mineral owner why they should sign with you and not with the company that's waiting in the driveway. So it was, you know, not as much, you know, I guess back then about the relationship, but, you know, things have certainly changed. And, you know, back then it was, your success was measured by, you know, how much acreage you're able to sign up, or, you know, being able to sign that surface lease on the first visits and not having a landowner, at least in Alberta, take their 48 hours, you know. And, and now, you know, it's, you know, we tell our land agents now here, you know, at Land Solutions anyways, that if it's a landowner that doesn't have experience with, you know, oil and gas or with the renewable sector, we don't encourage them to get, you know, even get the agreement, pen to agreement, the first visits, you know, make sure that they understand what they're signing, make sure that, you know, that relationship is starting to be established before asking them to sign that agreement. Back then, again, it was just all about getting it signed as quickly as you could.
Yeah, things have changed a lot. And I sense there's probably a lot behind how your, I guess, call it philosophy has changed over the years. And some, I think, you know, we're often driven by external factors, but I think we're also driven by an awareness that we develop through, you know, experience. And like, you know, we joke about being older, and but we could also hopefully say we're a bit wiser too. So take us on your journey. Like, so you started out, you know, working in Saskatchewan, and but I want to hear a bit about your journey and to help us connect the dots on how that philosophy changed for you over time. So take us on the career journey, like from connect the dots where from the Saskatchewan mineral lease acquisition to where you are today.
Yeah. So I worked out in Saskatchewan for about a year and a half, and then I was doing mostly Freehold Mineral leasing. And, you know, I went to Olds with the intent of, I guess, you know, I wanted to do surface land. And, you know, at the time, you know, work was starting to dry up a bit out there, and I had an opportunity to come back to Alberta with another company, which was called at the time LandPro, and they no longer exist. They were bought, or they changed their name and then were bought. But, you know, to be a surface landman, I guess. And I was actually only there for about 3 months before one of our clients, Crestar Energy. I had an interview with them for an in-house position. I guess, you know, my boss at the time, Jim Taylor, who's still in the business with Taylor Land Services, you know, he told me it was my irrigation farming background that got me the job, because the job was dealing with landowners. The area was down in southern Alberta around the Inchan Vauxhall area. And I did know a lot about irrigation, particularly having grown up on an irrigation farm. So I went in-house actually, you know, pretty quick. You know, only spent a year and a half, you know, on the broker side, went in-house, and I counted myself very fortunate, because it was late 1997, and, you know, 3 months after I went in-house, oil prices dropped, you know, to around $10 a barrel, and I was still, you know, I was collecting a salary, getting a paycheck, and my friends that were, you know, at brokers were, you know, struggling to even make ends meet. So I worked at Crestar, which then was bought by Gulf, and then Gulf was bought by Conoco, all in a span of 5 years. I worked for three different companies and basically sat in the same office. And anyway, in 2002, I think it was, had an opportunity to work at a junior oil and gas company. It was right at the, you know, the start of the boom of oil and gas and of the junior oil and gas industry. And from 2002 to 2006, I worked for three different companies. The reason I worked for three different companies is because all three of them sold. Anywhere from, I think the shortest stint I had was 7 months, and the longest was about 2 years before they sold. You know, and then in 2006, had an opportunity to go work for Quicksilver Resources, which was, you know, a mid-sized company. I think at the time they were around 15 or 20,000 BOE a day. CBM, coal bed methane company that was drilling about 500 CBM wells a year. So very busy, had a big team there. I believe when I started, there were about 12 in the land department that I was managing. So really big group. And, you know, great company, great people there. I was there for over 9 years. But unfortunately, you know, because they were, you know, focused on CBM and, you know, and dryer gas, they, you know, they also had property up in the Horn River Basin in Northeast BC, with the shale gas revolution. They were actually a product of their own demise. I mean, they were so good at, you know, finding gas in shale. They, you know, the gas outputs from companies like Quicksilver and other companies that had the same success, you know, led to the price collapse in natural gas, which, you know, has not even come back to this day. But anyway, so they were on the path, unfortunately, to bankruptcy. And I had a job opportunity at Nexen Energy working on an LNG project. And for the, you know, past, I don't know, 6 or 7 years at working at Quicksilver, starting in about 08, I had, you know, my career had started focusing more on Indigenous and stakeholder engagement. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. You know, this opportunity at Nexen came up, and it was dealing primarily, it was managing the stakeholder and Indigenous engagement for the Aurora LNG project out in the Prince Rupert area. And, you know, was fortunate to get that job. And you know, so that's where I spent, you know, 2 years from 2015 to 2017 before that project was canceled. And they let go of the majority of the of that team. And then, you know, that was in September of 2017. And I really, you know, I was treated pretty well by Nexen. So I was given an opportunity to, you know, take some time to decide what I really wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to stay in land and stay, you know, in engagement, but I also wanted to, you know, learn about some other sectors, you know, the renewable sector, the power sector, you know, power transmission line sector, and knew that if I was going to do that and go back in-house, I was, you know, probably going to take a big pay cut if I was, you know, starting out, you know, kind of in a new sector outside of oil and gas, or going back to, you know, work at a broker where, you know, at a company that, you know, was involved in all those different industries that I just mentioned. So, I mean, you and I started talking in late 2017, I think it was December of 2017, about, you know, me coming on board with Land Solutions and you know, started here at Land Solutions February 7th of 2018 and haven't looked back.
It sounds like there was a point in your career, maybe in the Quicksilver days, where this started, maybe a bit of a transition, and then definitely with Nexen, where the type of work you were doing may have contributed to a change in the way, maybe in the way you viewed things, or a change in your philosophy to doing things as it relates to access. So take us there. What occurred, and at what point did it occur that, you know, you started to see things differently?
I would take it further back than even Quicksilver. When I was working at, when Crestar got taken over by Gulf, I mean, you know, Crestar did not have, you know, a stakeholder or Indigenous relations. Back then it was called First Nations Department, and Gulf did. And, you know, when Gulf took Crestar over, we were more exposed to that. And the manager of that group at the time was a fellow by the name of Brian Plesic, who has now retired. I think Brian's been retired for 12 or 13 years. We still keep in touch. I go for lunch with Brian, you know, at least once a year, and we stay in touch. You know, and I learned tons from Brian, and he was actually, he was good friends and worked with Ron Vermeulen as well, one of Land Solutions founders. And I know that they still stay in touch as well. And, you know, one of the things that Brian had a lot of, we call them, you know, Brianisms. And one of them was, you need to date before you get married. And, you know, that focus was a lot more on building those relationships and engagement. And, you know, that was my first exposure to, that way of thinking, and particularly that way of thinking when dealing with Indigenous groups. And, you know, this is going back over 20 years. I mean, it was 2000 or 1999, I think, when Gulf took Crestar over. And, you know, so things were done a lot different back then. I remember when I was with Crestar, and, you know, you'd go up to, you know, Fort St. John to meet with an Indigenous group for, you know, drilling in their, you know, in their traditional lands. And, you know, it would be basically a chief and council meeting. I hate to say this, but you'd bring, you know, a couple boxes of donuts to that chief and council meeting, tell them about the project, promise a couple of jobs, and they would sign off. And you think of how far that's come now. I mean, you know, with Indigenous groups, you know, having skin in the game, being involved in these projects and being investors in these projects and actually, you know, leading a lot of these projects. You know, so, you know, 20 years is not a long time. And, you know, it's come a long way since then. But, you know, I think, you know, it goes back to that far that, you know, there's not one single moment. There are a lot of different moments along the way. You know, I would say that was probably the moment that, you know, really started to change my thinking was, you know, when I started working for Gulf and they just had a different way of dealing with stakeholders and Indigenous groups.
From there, then, as your career went on, it sounds to me like that served as a bit of a foundation for you that you took with you to your
yeah.
you know, the next opportunities. Would you yeah. say that the, you know, with the type of work that you do, there's a lot of different types of stakeholders that you deal with. Give us a kind of the spectrum of the different types of people that you've developed rapport with over the years of your career and help us understand if were there some that were more complex to deal with than others.
Yeah, I think, I mean, each stakeholder groups or Indigenous group have, you know, they bring their own, I guess, set of complexities. And, you know, I go back to when I was dealing with landowners and, you know, that was back in the days when, you know, when I first started in land, even in starting in Alberta in land, there was no such thing as D56. That was brought in, I think, in around 1998. So, you know, it worked as a land agent for a couple of years before that was even a thing. So you basically just dealt with the landowner. Your field file maybe had 20 sheets of paper in it. You know, now there's some field files that, you know, would have over 100 sheets of paper in it. And you would sign that landowner up and that was about it. You drill that well and then, you know, sign the landowner up and his neighbors up for a pipeline. You know, now with, you know, with D56, you're having to deal with all sorts of stakeholders and some that are getting paid for the compensation because that well or that pipeline is on the land and others that aren't receiving it. So, you know, the role of a land agent at least has changed considerably, you know, from being a, you know, just solely a negotiator to, you know, being a combination of a negotiator, consultation, you know, engagement experts. And, you know, dealing with a lot of different stakeholders, many with different priorities. I mean, that landowner, he's obviously where that well is. He's obviously going to have a different set of concerns than his neighbor that's 2 miles away that, you know, may not be getting any compensation, but still has to deal with, you know, that oil well or, you know, or that wind turbine that might be on his neighbor's land. So, you know, the complexities have changed considerably, primarily because the regulations have changed. You know, as far as dealing with Indigenous groups, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, you know, we used to, you know, go out and it was, you know, maybe one or two visits and you get something signed. Now, I mean, you know, when I was at Nexen, you know, we worked on an agreement, one that I probably started, you know, within a few weeks or a couple months of starting at Nexen, and it took a year and a half to get that agreement signed. You know, I mean, this agreement was worth millions of dollars. So obviously a lot more complex than, you know, signing a surface lease that, you know, might be worth $30,000 or $35,000 and a lot more people involved in it. You know, as far as, you know, the complexities of it, yeah, I mean, there's a wide spectrum. It's, you know, signing a, like I said, a single surface lease with one landowner to dealing with an Indigenous group who has lawyers involved. There's more players involved. You're dealing with the chief in the council, you're dealing with other band members, but you're also have more people on your, I guess, negotiating or engagement team as well that you have to help out and you know, with different sets of different skill sets.
I think with a lot of things is as regulation changes, the skill set required to do this kind of work has sounds like it's increased. I mean, that's what I've seen. And I think it sounds like that's what you've seen as you've gone from negotiating a surface lease that's maybe the stakes are, like you say, $30,000 to negotiating an agreement that's worth millions of dollars and probably has a much greater impact to the project that you were working to gain access for. So the stakes are higher.
Yeah, definitely.
So what do you think, since you started your career, do you think the regulatory environment has been the biggest catalyst for change, like, or for the increase to the complexity of the work that we do when we're securing access?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of them. As I mentioned earlier, when I first started my career, you know, D56 didn't even exist. There were very few, I guess, regulations around dealing with stakeholders outside of the stakeholders that were immediately impacted by the project. You know, and the regulations have changed, you know, some good, some bad. I mean, the timelines for getting, you know, major projects across the finish line, you know, back, you know, when we started, not that I was involved in major projects, but, you know, I know that they would be measured in months, and now they're measured in, you know, in years. And I mean, you know, it could be 3, 4, 5 years or even longer before some of these projects, especially, you know, up here in Canada are approved. You know, but there are other things as well. I mean, there's some court decisions, especially that involve Indigenous groups. They've certainly, that has changed the landscape as well. And, you know, having to consult with Indigenous groups, you know, because of their traditional lands, their rights, which have been more defined, you know, through court decisions, that has changed a lot as well. You know, back, like, again, when I started, you know, dealing with some of these Indigenous groups, it was, you know, almost an afterthought, and a lot of times wasn't even required. And now that's a big part of our industry, both, you know, in oil and gas, you know, the renewable sector, transmission and infrastructure sector. I think all sectors are impacted by that.
With that in mind, how do you think your own principles or your philosophy around engagement have changed through your career?
I was fortunate. You know, I, you know, grew up, you know, on a farm, as I mentioned, and our hired hands at the time were, you know, we had a couple different ones that were Indigenous guys who had their whole families living in the house, in the hired hand house on our farm. And so I grew up, you know, I guess I didn't have any of those, negative, I guess, issues that some people might have with Indigenous people. I, you know, just viewed them as, you know, in a lot of cases, just my friends. And so I think that certainly helped, you know, with my career. But, you know, as I got to work more with Indigenous peoples, I had, you know, some aha moments. You know, one of them being that, you know, as Euro-Canadians, we, you know, view things much different, you know, and I'll use property ownership as an example. You know, Euro-Canadians, you know, we have a title to our property and it's ours, you know, to do, you know, with certain restrictions, obviously, what we want to do with that property. You know, Indigenous people view property as, or land as sacred. They view it as living relatives. Like you can't, so therefore you can't own it. And, you know, so I don't even think that property ownership, like there's a definition for it in, you know, Indigenous languages. It's not something you can own. And, you know, that's one thing that, you know, I guess as a Euro-Canadian and as Euro-Canadians need to get their heads wrapped around is that when you're engaging with them on a new project, you know, how that project is going to impact Indigenous groups differently than what we think or how we think it will impact them when they consider the land, the water, the resources as a living sacred thing that they're related to. Mm. And, you know, I think I had several experiences, well, more than several, I had many experiences, but, you know, a couple that I can think of off the top of my head, you know, and one of them being, I was invited, this is probably about 10 years ago, to go on a moose hunting trip up in the Northwest Territories with the chief of Atchedenico First Nation and some of his friends and a couple council members. There were two boatloads of us, probably about 8 or 9 in total, and we spent 3 days and 2 nights traveling up the Liard River moose hunting. And you know, I really, you know, that from that trip especially got a sense for understanding of how Indigenous people do view the land and how much they do respect it. You know, fortunately we didn't get any moose. But we were like literally you know, staying in cabins that they had hand built. You know, no wasted resources there. They cut down the trees that they needed to build that cabin, and that was it. Any of the, you know, shavings from those logs or branches they cut off, they saved in a pile to be used for, you know, for burning, for, you know, for firewood. The boats that they hand built their boats. I think the only kind of, I guess, modern thing that they had was motors and fuel to, you know, to get those boats up river. But it was an experience that I'll never forget. And, you know, that I would say that there are other experiences that I've certainly had throughout my career. But that was definitely one of them that was, you know, kind of defining for me, that people like Indigenous people, like there are still people that truly do live off the land. They obviously, you know, have some modern conveniences. You know, do they need them? I don't know that they need some of the modern conveniences. I think they, you know, it makes it easier. I'll tell you what, if there was ever like a zombie apocalypse, I would be going north with my family to, you know, meet up with, you know, some of those Indigenous folks that I still stay in touch with these days, you know, to live with them, because I know that I'd be well taken care of and, you know, could get by without the modern conveniences that we have become accustomed to.
It sounds like you've been able to appreciate the different perspectives that people have. And I think that's really an important piece of being successful in this business. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about, you know, your story about the moose hunting sounds like quite the experience. Tell us about what's one of the craziest things that you've encountered? You know, when you're going out to meet people sometimes in the middle of nowhere, let's say, you meet some interesting folks. Anything crazy happen along the way?
Well, I mean, I guess, landman, I've had my share of dealings with interesting people, you know, which included threats of violence. You know, one thing, we usually knew who those people were that might be difficult to deal with. So we, you know, generally, if not all the time, bring someone else with us. I'd always bring someone that I knew I could outrun. You know, that was always a smart thing to do, but no, I'm kidding. But, you know, I guess, you know, there's a couple stories that stand out. And I guess probably one that was early in my career when I was actually still working in Saskatchewan. I had this meeting and I remember it being really difficult to even get a hold of this guy. They didn't have a phone. And so I had to actually get a hold of their neighbor, who then, you know, had them call me back from their phone. And, you know, it was for a Free Old mineral lease. And it was a piece of land that was really important to our clients and so needed to get it signed. And it was out near the Manitoba border, Saskatchewan-Manitoba border. And anyways, I remember pulling into the driveway and, you know, it was a well-kept farmyard. And but the one, there was two brothers, they were bachelor brothers that were in their, you know, late 50s. And I pull into their farmyard, and I see one of the brothers, and he's walking towards the house. It's pretty obvious I was driving in. I was only maybe, you know, 20 meters away from him as I was driving in, and he didn't even look at me. He just had, like, he was just walking straight to the house. And I, you know, I remember thinking that was a little bit weird. And so I get out of my truck and go up to the house and knock on the door. And it was just, all I heard was, "Come in." And so walk in and, you know, take off my shoes as I usually do. And I look peer around the corner, and the guys, the brothers are sitting at the kitchen table, and they're not looking at me. You know, they're kind of looking down at the table, and the entire kitchen, and as I found out later from what I could see at the house, was plastered like wallpaper with Playboy centerfolds. Like the entire, like it was the most bizarre. So of course I'm like, you know, kind of very creeped out, but weirdly intrigued at the same time. And it's like, what am I getting myself into? Anyway, you know, at the end of the day, these two bachelor brothers, that like I said, they were in their 50s. I think I was in and out of there maybe 15 or 20 minutes, but I was certainly, you know, creeped out by that. And anyway, that was like probably 6 months into my career. And there's been some weird things that have happened to me since then, but that's one that, I don't know if that was because that was one of the first weird things, if not the very first weird thing that happened to me, but that I will never forget that and remember all the details of that happening.
What's the biggest aha moment you've had along your journey?
Well, I mean, again, I think it goes back to what I said earlier, just dealing with Indigenous people and how their values and cultures are so much different than ours. And, you know, how they, you know, their how they treat the land, how, you know, they, you know, their family units are different. You know, they're, you know, using as an example, I mean, an Indigenous person, you know, for a Euro-Canadian person, we go to a funeral. And, you know, a funeral for, you know, a friend or a relative or something. And, you know, unless they're a close relative, if it's like a, you know, a distant uncle or something like that, you go to the funeral and, you know, you're sad about it. And, but then, you know, it's like a 1 day affair basically, or a half day affair in some cases, you know, for an Indigenous person, you know, that could take a week. They could be off work for a week. You know, if it's like it could be a distant uncle. But just the respect that they have for family, you know, that they may be gone for a week attending that funeral. And that's just something that I guess that we as Euro-Canadians, again, don't understand, that we need to learn to understand, you know, when you know, especially when you've got an Indigenous person working for you, if they're gone for several days, that might be why. And, you know, the other thing is, too, you know, the money means different things to Indigenous people. And I'm not saying all, but I would say more, from a cultural perspective, I've worked with some, you know, folks up north, you know, some trappers that have worked, you know, and worked their butts off, you know, all summer. They worked their butts off and they're on time every day, but all of a sudden, you know, they're like, you know, they either don't show up for work for one day or they pick up the phone and say, I'm done. And it's because, you know, hunting season has started, you know, or trapping season has started. And then they are gone for 4 or 5 months and, you know, they're, you know, living off the land for 4 or 5 months. Then all of a sudden you get a call and, you know, in the spring and, you know, can I have my job back? I'm, you know, done my, you know, my hunting or my trapping. But, you know, that's how they're stocking up. That's how they're providing for their family. It's a combination of making money, you know, with a regular paycheck, but also, you know, going back to their roots and, you know, doing things traditional way, making sure that's, you know, that's staying with them and providing for their families that way. And so, you know, I guess the biggest aha is just the differences that we have versus Indigenous people and, you know, understanding that so that you're better able to, you know, engage with them and understand why they may have issues with a project that you think they shouldn't have issues with.
What do you think the future holds for the, you know, developers that, or those that require access to build something, whatever industry it is, what do you think the future looks like? Is it one where there's growing complexity? What do you see?
Well, I don't see it getting easier. I think we've gone through some fundamental changes here with the changes in regulations and, you know, some of the court decisions that I mentioned earlier. You know, I think specifically for land agents, you know, coming out of Olds College in 1996, you didn't even think about other sectors. You went into oil and gas. And I would say out of the 17 people that I graduated with, you know, pretty much, I think I would say all of them found jobs in, you know, in as a land agent or as a land administrator, and all of them went into oil and gas. You know, now coming out of Olds College, or, you know, if you're a land agent that's having trouble finding a job in oil and gas, I mean, you need to be more diverse, you need to be open to learning about other sectors. You know, I think, you know, I'll look at the renewable sector and, you know, I think that mindset is definitely changing, but even as little as, you know, when 3 years ago when I started at Land Solutions, there were still those naysayers, you know, that were out there and, you know, friends of mine that I've known for years that thought that the renewable sector was just, you know, it was a blip, that it was, you know, that it would just eventually go away, that there wasn't much opportunity, especially, you know, here, you know, maybe wind, because it does blow a lot in Southern Alberta, you know, but that was kind of the beginning of the solar industry coming into Western Canada. And, you know, we have a lot of sun in Southern Alberta, but we also have a long winter. And there were, like I said, a lot of naysayers. But I mean, as we can see, especially, you know, you're reading the news lately, you know, companies like, you know, Amazon that are partnering with, you know, with Greengate to develop, you know, solar projects. And, you know, a big solar project 2 or 3 years ago was, you know, 50 megawatts, sorry. And you look at that Greengate solar project down around Loman, it's 460 megawatts of power. I mean, that's huge. You know, that's taken up, you know, 4 or 5,000 acres of land. And there's a lot of opportunities out there, you know, not just for those types of projects, but, you know, for the transmission lines that the power has to go into, and then the distribution lines, you know. And so the days of, you know, land agents being focused on oil and gas, you know, that's changed. I mean, there's the renewable sector, there's the transmission sector, infrastructure, telecom. There's a lot of different opportunities out there for land agents. Mm-hmm. You know, so that, you know, specifically for land agents, I think that, you know, industry, looking at it from a more macro level, you know, you can't pick up the DOB these days or the newspaper without reading about ESG. And I think that, you know, a year ago, I would say probably 90% of the, you know, downtown Calgary didn't know what, maybe not downtown Calgary, but 90% of Albertans didn't know what ESG was. And I would say that, you know, a lot of people do now. And I think that, you know, it was mostly the Suncors and the CNRLs, the bigger companies in the past that had ESG reports. But now you're seeing much smaller companies, you know, that have these ESG reports. And even I believe that you'll see suppliers to those companies, like privately owned supplier companies, that will have, you know, be putting out ESG reports. And I also think that there's going to be, you know, right now there's certainly an Indigenous component to it. And I think that's a big part of it. I think, you know, don't mark my words, but I wouldn't be surprised if those ESG reports change to ESIG reports, you know, adding in, you know, Indigenous in there, because of the large component that I think that you're seeing more of these reports taken up with, you know, Indigenous, you know, collaborations and partnerships, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I think too that, you know, 20 years ago, as I said earlier, there was the Indigenous partnerships was, you know, promising a couple of jobs to, you know, someone from that particular First Nation that's impacted by the project. And now, I mean, you're seeing full on, you know, partnerships and skin in the game partnerships where Indigenous groups are, you know, providing funding to these projects and leading these projects. You know, you look at Haida, you know, out in on the West Coast there, you know, they've got their own LNG project that they're looking at developing. You know, the partnerships that they've made with companies like Shell, you know, to develop those that LNG, and, you know, up in the oil sands, Fort McKay First Nations, and, you know, taking over that, buying that tank farm from Suncor. There's all kinds, and these aren't like millions of dollars of projects. These are like hundreds of millions of dollars in projects, and the funding that they have access to, the access to capital is much different. You know, I think that there are a lot of banks that you know, have, you know, set aside a certain amount of funding that is available to Indigenous groups. And I just think that industry needs to, you know, look towards more partnerships with these groups and having, you know, Indigenous groups getting skin in the game. And that will lead to a lot more, you know, opportunities for these Indigenous groups, but also opportunities for the companies, by getting them across, getting these projects across the across the finish line. Mm-hmm. From a regulatory aspect.
Last question for you. What advice would you give to, you know, a developer of any kind of project? Let's just say a developer that requires access to land, whether it's to build a telecommunications tower or to help them increase their chance of success in securing access.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of different things, but I think fundamentally it comes down to a couple different things, in relationship and collaboration. And, you know, on the relationship side, you know, I think that, you know, seen it time and time again, you know, if you spend the money up front, take the time to get to know the stakeholder group or Indigenous group that you're dealing with, you will save that money down the road. And it's, you know, it might be hard to quantify. You know, there are certainly ways to track it. But I bet you 10 out of 10 times, if you know, focus more of that investment up front on building that relationship, you will save money in the long term. I mean, just you think about timelines alone. You know, if you can get an Indigenous group on side with your project, you know, either through, you know, some type of partnership arrangement or, you know, a joint venture or some type of collaboration, you know, agreements, you know, that's probably the biggest hurdle for major projects is getting sign off, you know, approval for the projects from Indigenous groups. And if you can get that, you've pretty much got a project guaranteed. Mm-hmm. You know, and then on the collaboration side, you know, I would say this both for, you know, if you're, you know, in say in our case or you know, a company that's looking to build a project, you know, in something, you know, in our case as a land solutions, I look at, you know, collaboration, like I'm a competitive person, don't get me wrong. But if I don't think that I'm going to win a project, you know, or a company is able to build that project, you know, without having a good partner to, you know, to help you with that, you know, I'd rather have 50% of that project than get, you know, zero, you know, and get that, you know, get that project across the finish line. You might have to give up something, but the return is you actually get to build that project. And, you know, you might not have 100% of it, but at least you'll have, you know, a portion of it and be able to you know, actually, you know, either proceed with that project, be a part of it, or actually build that project. You know, and I would say too, with, you know, more on a micro level with land agents, you know, dealing with stakeholders, you know, or Indigenous groups, you know, always have a plan B. You know, rarely, you know, do things go as planned, you know, and dealing with stakeholders or Indigenous groups, you know, always have that, you know, alternative, you know, pipeline route or transmission route or alternative, you know, well site or turbine placement and, you know, visualize, you know, and I used to do this when I was going out, you know, and I don't do this as much. I love the operational aspect of, you know, of going out and, you know, and dealing with stakeholders. And I, you know, with this, the role that I'm in right now, I really miss that part of it, you know, but when I went out and I was, you know, traveling out to the site or to meet with that group, I would always visualize my meeting with them. And I would, you know, visualize that, you know, I'd put a negotiation plan together. I'd visualize how that would play out. And, you know, I would, you know, think to myself, if I say this, how will they respond? And, you know, how will I then respond with that? And, you know, I think just like in sports, you know, sports psychologists, you know, say visualize that game. I would do the same in my negotiation, you know, or engagement with those stakeholders or Indigenous groups.
That's really great advice. Jason, thanks for coming on the show today. I coming away with some new insights to your journey, and I'm sure our listeners are going to find this episode really interesting. And those that know you through the industry will appreciate how you came to be the success you are. That was fun.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it. And I hope that, you know, for anybody that's listening to this, you know, they can learn from it. And, you know, if anybody actually that's listening to this that has some questions about, you know, anything we've talked about here, I would, you know, love to carry on the conversation with them.
How can people reach you if they want to get a hold of you? What's the best way?
I mean, I'm a bit old school, so, you know, giving me a call or just emailing me, you know, would probably be the best way.
Oh, that's great. I will make sure that we include your email address in the show notes details with this episode.
That sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Well, have a great day.
All right. You too. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks so much for listening to Elevated Access, the inside story. I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks' time for another great conversation with industry leaders in the energy and infrastructure space. If you enjoyed the show today, I'd really appreciate it if you subscribed and gave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. This goes a long way in helping other people find the podcast. If you've got questions, comments, or a suggestion for a future guest, please reach out to us at guest@elevated-access.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Chad Hughes. Talk to you next time.